It was fitting, then, that the obscurity of anger be corrected by clarity, and after that, by truthfulness. For besides its other traits, anger has this one of its own: falsehood. Of those, at least, who indulge this passion, hardly anyone speaks the truth, mastered as he is by a drunkenness not of the body, but of the soul. These are the remedies for the spirited part. Reason, the clarity of reason, and its truth for the three are in effect one thing, reason together with the virtues of truthfulness and clarity, healing the grievous sickness of the soul that is anger. To whom, then, does it belong to bear these things? Not to my understanding, nor to that of just anyone, but to the consecrated understanding, that of Aaron, and not even to his at every moment. For it often turns aside, but only when it proceeds without turning, when it enters the sanctuary, when reasoning enters together with holy resolves and does not run away from them. But often the mind enters with holy and pure and cleansed judgments into sacred and hallowed opinions. But these are merely human ones, such as those concerning what is fitting, those concerning right actions, those concerning what is lawful by convention, those concerning human virtue. Not even one so disposed is fit to bear the oracle upon his breast along with the virtues, but only the one who goes in before the Lord. That is, the one who does everything for God's sake and holds nothing that comes after God in the highest honor. But who, while granting to these lesser things what is due to them, does not stop at them, but presses on to the knowledge and understanding and honor of the one. For to one so disposed, spirited anger will be reined in both by reason that has been purified, which strips away its irrational element, and by clarity, which heals what is unclear and confused, and by truthfulness, which cuts away falsehood. Aaron, then, for he is second to Moses in excising the breast, which is spirited anger, does not allow it to be carried off by unjudged impulses, fearing lest, once let loose, it rear up like a horse and trample the whole soul. Instead, he tends and bridles it, first by reason, so that, using an excellent charioteer, it may not run wildly out of control, and then by the virtues of reason, clarity, and truth. For if anger is so trained that it yields to reason and to clarity and practices freedom from falsehood, it will free itself from much of its boiling and will render the whole soul more settled. But this man, as I have said, having the passion, tries to heal it with the saving remedies I have mentioned, whereas Moses thinks it necessary to cut out and remove anger from the soul entirely, cherishing not moderation of passion, but complete freedom from passion altogether. The most sacred oracle bears witness to my argument. Moses, it says, took the breast and set it aside as a portion before the Lord, from the ram of consecration, and it became Moses' share. Lev. 8:29. Very well said, for it was the work of one who loves virtue and is loved by God, having beheld the whole soul, to take hold of the breast, which is spirited anger, and remove and cut it away, so that, once the warlike part is excised, the rest may live in peace. And he takes it not from just any animal, but from the ram of consecration, even though a calf too had been sacrificed. But passing over that, he came to the ram, because the ram is by nature a budding, spirited, and impulsive creature, for which reason engineers construct most of their siege engines as rams. The ram-like, impulsive, and unjudging element in us, then, is the contentious kind, and strife is the mother of anger, which is why the more quarrelsome are quickest to grow angry, both in disputes and in other conversations. From the contentious and quarrelsome soul, then, he fittingly cuts out anger, its faulty offspring, so that once made barren, it may cease bearing harmful things, and there may come to be a portion fitting for the lover of virtue, not the breast, nor the anger, but the removal of them. For God has allotted to the wise the noblest of portions, the ability to cut out the passions. Do you see how the perfect man is always practicing perfect freedom from passion? But he who is only advancing, being second to Aaron, practices moderation of passion, as I said, for he is not yet able to cut out the breast and the anger. Instead, he brings to bear upon it, as charioteer, reason together with its inborn virtues, the oracle, in which lies clarity and truth. He will make the difference still clearer through this as well. For I have taken the breast of the portion and the shoulder of the offering from the sons of Israel, from the sacrifices of your deliverance, and I have given them to Aaron and his sons, Lev. 7:34. You see that these men are not able to take the breast alone, but only together with the shoulder, whereas Moses takes it without the shoulder. Why? Because the perfect man thinks nothing small or lowly, nor does he wish merely to moderate the passions, but out of his abundance, he has cut off the passions entirely and completely. Whereas the others set out against the war of the passions only in a small and modest way, and instead come to terms and make a truce with them, offering reconciling reason as a mediator, so that, like a charioteer, it may check their excessive rush. The shoulder is also a symbol of toil and hardship, and such is the attendant and minister of holy things, one who makes use of practice and toil. But free of toil is the one to whom God grants, out of great abundance, goods that are already perfect. And one who acquires virtue through toil is found to be lesser and less complete than one who, like Moses, receives it from God without toil and with ease. For just as toiling itself is a lesser and smaller thing than freedom from toil, so too the incomplete is less than the complete, and the one who is learning is less than the one who is taught by himself. For this reason, Aaron takes the breast together with the shoulder, but Moses takes it without the shoulder. He calls the breast a portion for this reason. Reason must lie upon anger and be seated firmly over it, like a charioteer guiding a stiff-necked and unruly horse. But he no longer calls the shoulder a portion, but an offering, for this reason. The soul must not draw to itself the toil expended for virtue, but must remove it from itself and refer it up to God, confessing that it was not her own strength or power that secured the good, but the one who granted even the love of it as a gift. Neither the breast nor the shoulder is taken except from the sacrifice of deliverance, and reasonably so, for the soul is delivered only when anger, too, is reined in by reason, and toil does not build up self-conceit, but instead yields the credit to God the benefactor. That pleasure travels not only upon its breast, but also upon its belly, we have already said, showing that the belly is the region most proper to pleasure. For it is, in effect, the vessel that holds nearly all pleasures. For when the belly is filled, the appetites for the other pleasures too grow intense, but when it is emptied, they grow calm and more settled. That is also why he says elsewhere, "Everyone that goes upon its belly, and everyone that goes always upon 4 feet, and has many feet, is unclean." Lev. 11:42. Such is the lover of pleasure, always making his way toward the belly and the pleasures that follow it. And he has joined the creature that crawls on its belly with the one that walks on 4 feet, reasonably so, for there are 4 passions belonging to pleasure, as a particular account, taken separately, records. Unclean, then, is both the one who indulges the single pleasure and the one who rushes after all 4. Having said this, observe again the difference between the perfect man and the one who is advancing. Just as before we found that the perfect man cuts out the whole of the anger belonging to the contentious soul, making it tame and manageable and peaceable and gentle toward everyone in both deed and word, while the one who is advancing, unable to remove the passion entirely. For he still bears the breast, trains it instead by judged reason, possessing the 2 virtues of clarity and truth. So now too we will find that the wise and perfect man, Moses, wipes away and shakes off pleasures altogether, while the one who is advancing does not reject every pleasure, but admits the necessary and simple kind while refusing the elaborate and excessive kind found in fancy side dishes. For of Moses it says, "And he washed the belly and the feet with the water of the whole burnt offering." Lev. 9:14. Very fittingly, for since the whole soul is worthy to be brought before God, having neither voluntary nor involuntary blemish, the wise man consecrates it entirely. And being so disposed, he washes and cleanses and scours away the entire belly and the pleasures belonging to it and following after it, not merely a part, but has come to hold it in such contempt that he does not even take the necessary food or drink, being nourished instead by the contemplation of divine things. That is why it is also attested of him elsewhere. For 40 days he ate no bread and drank no water, Exod. 34:28, when he was on the divine mountain listening to God's oracles as he legislated. But he not only renounces the whole belly, but also has its feet scoured away together with it, that is, the paths of approach to pleasure. The paths of approach to pleasure are the things that produce it. For the one who is advancing is said to wash the inward parts and the feet, Lev. 1:9, but not the whole belly. He is not capable of driving off every pleasure, but it is enough if he washes its inward parts, that is, its rich side dishes, which lovers of pleasure call refinements upon the basic pleasures, produced through the elaborate skill of relish makers and fastidious bakers. And he further intensifies the moderation of the one who is advancing by this, that the one man renounces the whole pleasure of the belly without any command, while the one who is advancing does so only under command. For of the wise man it is said thus, he washed the belly and the feet with water, Lev. 9:14, unprompted by his own voluntary judgment, but of the priests it says, the inward parts and the feet not they washed, but they shall wash, Lev. 1:9, very precisely observed, for the perfect man must be moved to actions of virtue from himself, while the one still in training needs the guidance of reason to instruct him in what must be done. And it is good for him to obey when it commands. One must not fail to notice that Moses, in renouncing the whole belly, that is, the filling of the stomach, thereby renounces almost all the other passions as well, since the lawgiver, by dealing with one single part, is clearly setting forth the whole, and through the most all-embracing thing is describing by implication the others too, concerning which he kept silent. For the filling of the belly is the most all-embracing thing, and, as it were, a foundation of the other passions. For none of them can be established at all except by resting upon the belly, upon which nature has grounded everything. For this reason, once the goods of the soul born of Lee had first come into being and had come to rest upon the confession of Judah, Gen 29:35. God, being about to fashion also the advances of the body, prepares Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, to bear children even before her mistress. Bilhah means swallowing down, for he knew that nothing bodily can come into being without swallowing and the belly, but that the belly rules and governs the whole body and the bare mass that belongs to mere living. Observe every fine point, for you will find nothing said carelessly. Moses removes the breast, but does not remove the belly, he washes it instead, Lev. 8:29, 9:14. Why? Because the perfect man has the strength to renounce and cut off anger entirely, rising up against wrath, but he is unable to cut out the belly. For nature compels even the man who needs least and holds the necessities in contempt, and who practices abstaining even from them, to make use of necessary food and drink. Let him wash it then, and cleanse it of superfluous and unclean preparations, for even this is a sufficient gift from God to the lover of virtue. That is why, concerning the soul suspected of having been corrupted Num. 5:27, he says that if she is found to have abandoned right reason, which is a lawful husband, and to have gone over to the passion that defiles the soul, her belly will swell, which is to say, she will have the pleasures and appetites of the belly unfillable and insatiable, and, through lack of discipline, she will never cease being greedy, but as countless things flow in upon her, she will have the passion forever. I know, indeed, many who stumble so badly over the appetite of the belly that, after resorting to vomiting, they rush again towards strong wine and everything else. For the desire of a soul without self-mastery is not proportioned to the bulk of the body. Bodies, being vessels of a measured capacity, admit nothing beyond measure, but expel what is superfluous, whereas desire is never filled, but remains forever in want and athirst. That is why the consequence added to the swelling of the belly is the falling away of the thigh. For at that time, there also falls away from the soul the upright reason that is generative and productive of noble things. If, it says, she has not been defiled and is pure, she shall be free and shall bear seed. Num 5:28, meaning that if she has not been defiled by passion but remains pure toward her lawful husband, the sound and guiding reason, she will have a soul fruitful and bearing fruit, carrying offspring of prudence and righteousness. And consistent with this, the swelling of the belly is followed by the thigh falling away. For then the seed-bearing and generative right reason of noble things falls away in the soul. At any rate, he says, if she has not been defiled and is pure, she shall be free of guilt and shall bear seed. Num 5:28, meaning, if the soul has not been defiled by passion but keeps herself pure for her lawful husband, the sound and ruling reason, she will have a soul fertile and fruitful, bearing offspring of prudence and justice and of virtue entire. Is it possible, then, for us who are bound to a body, not to make use of the body's necessities? How could it be? But observe, the Hierophant lays down the manner in which the one led by bodily need is to make use of only what is necessary. First he says, "Let there be a place for you outside the camp." Deut 23:12, calling virtue the camp in which the soul has taken up its station, for prudence and the enjoyment of bodily necessity cannot hold the same ground. Then he says, "You shall go out there, outside." Why? Because the soul, while it remains with prudence and abides in the house of wisdom, cannot make use of any of the body's friends, for then it is nourished on more divine food, in the sciences, on whose account it also neglects the flesh. But whenever it goes out of the sacred houses of virtue, then it turns to the matters that offend and oppress the body. How then shall I make use of them? "Let there be a peg for you upon your girdle," he says, "and you shall dig with it," Deut 23:13. That is, let reason dig into the passion and hold it back and strip it bare, for the passions want us girded up, not worn loose and slack. This is why, at the crossing over that is called Passover, he commands that the loins be girded, Exod 12:11, that is, that the desires be drawn in. Let the peg, that is, reason, then follow upon the passion, preventing it from being let loose. For so we shall make use of necessities alone, and abstain from what is superfluous. And even when we are at gatherings, and about to come to the enjoyment and use of what has been prepared, if we come armed with reason as with a defensive weapon, we shall neither gorge ourselves on food beyond measure, gull-like, nor, once glutted with unmixed wine beyond measure, give ourselves over to the drunkenness that compels folly. For reason will muzzle and bridle the rush and onset of passion. I know this from having suffered it myself many times. For when I have come to an unruly gathering and lavish dinners, whenever I did not arrive together with reason, I became a slave of what had been prepared, led about by untamed masters, spectacles and sounds, and whatever produces pleasures through the nostrils and the taste. But whenever I came with reason as my guide, I became master instead of slave, and won by main force a noble victory of endurance and self-control, resisting and contending against all that unleashes uncontrolled desires. "You shall dig," he says, "with the peg," Deut 23:13. That is, whatever nature each of these things has, eating, drinking, using what comes after the belly, you shall lay bare and distinguish with reason, so that by discerning you may know the truth. For then you will know that the good lies in none of these things, but only the necessary and useful. And having covered it over, you shall conceal your shame. Ibid. Very well said. For bring reason to bear, O soul, upon everything, by which all the shamefulness of flesh and passion is covered, overshadowed, and hidden away. For all that is without reason is shameful, just as all that is with reason is decorous. Accordingly, the lover of pleasure walks upon his belly, while the perfect man washes out the belly entirely. The one making progress deals with what is in the belly, while the one just beginning to be trained goes forth outside, whenever he is about to bring reason to bear upon the necessities of the belly, to muzzle the passion which is symbolically called the peg. And it is well said further, "You shall go upon your breast and belly," Gen 3:14. For pleasure belongs not to what stands still, but to what is in motion and full of turmoil. For as flame is in motion, so passion, moving in the soul after the manner of a blaze, does not allow it to be at rest. Hence it does not agree with those who say pleasure is a settled state, for stillness belongs to stone and wood and everything soulless, but is foreign to pleasure, which craves titillation and spasm, and in some cases has need not of stillness, but of intense and violent motion. "And you shall eat earth all the days of your life," Gen 3:14. This is fittingly said, for the pleasures of bodily nourishment are earthly. And perhaps rightly so, for we are composed of two things, mind and body. The body has been fashioned out of earth, but the soul is of ether, a divine fragment. For God breathed into his face the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Gen 2:7. Reasonably, then, the body, molded from earth, has kindred nourishment which the earth yields up, while the soul, being a portion of ethereal nature, has in turn ethereal and divine nourishment. For it is fed on sciences, not on food or drink, of which the body has need. And that the soul's nourishments are not earthly but heavenly, the sacred word will testify at greater length. "Behold, I shall rain down for you loaves from heaven, and the people shall go out and gather each day's portion for that day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not." Exod 16:4. You see that the soul is nourished not on earthly and perishable things, but on whatever words God rains down out of that lofty and pure nature which he has called heaven. Let the people, then, the whole constitution of the soul, go out and gather and begin upon knowledge, not all at once, but each day's portion for that day. For first, taken all at once, it will not be able to contain the great wealth of God's graces, but will be flooded like a torrent's onrush. And further, it is better, having received sufficient and measured goods, to think God the steward of the rest. But the one who pursues everything all at once acquires despair and disbelief, along with great folly. He becomes despairing if he hopes that God will rain down good things now only and not again. Disbelieving, if he has not believed that God's graces are bestowed ungrudgingly on the worthy both now and always. And senseless, if he thinks himself able to be a sufficient guardian of what has been gathered without God's will. For a small tilt is enough to render null and insecure, through his own vainglory, everything of which the mind that fastens security and certainty upon itself supposed it was guardian. Gather then, O soul, what is sufficient and fitting, neither more than enough so as to overreach, nor again less so as to fall short, that using just measures you may do no wrong. For indeed the soul that is practicing the crossing over from the passions and sacrificing the Passover, the progress that is the sheep, must take it without excess. For each one, he says, shall be counted for the sheep according to what suffices him, Exod 12:4. So too with the manna and with every gift that God gives to our race, it is good to take the measured and numbered amount, not more than falls to us, for that would be greed. Let the soul, then, gather each day's portion for that day, Exod 16:4, so that it may show not itself but the gift-loving God to be the guardian of good things. And for this reason, I think, the passage before us is stated as it is. Day is a symbol of light, and the light of the soul is education. Many, then, have acquired the lights within the soul unto night and darkness, not unto day and light, such as all the preliminary studies, the so-called general education, and philosophy itself, pursued for luxury's sake or for advancement with rulers. But the man of worth acquires the day for the day's sake, and the light for the light's sake, and the noble for the sake of the noble alone, not for the sake of anything else. Hence he adds, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not, Exod 16:4. For this is a divine law, that virtue for its own sake. Right reason tests its practitioners like a coin, to see whether they are debased, referring the soul's good to something external, or whether, as a proved coin, they keep it distinct, guarding it in the understanding alone. It falls to such as these to be nourished not on earthly, but on heavenly sciences. He makes this clear also through other words, when he says, it came to pass in the morning, as the dew ceased round about the camp, that behold, upon the face of the wilderness there was a fine thing like coriander seed, white like frost upon the ground. And when they saw it, they said to one another, what is this? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given us to eat. This is the word which the Lord has ordained. Exod 16:13 FF. You see what the soul's food is like. The continuous word of God, resembling dew, encompassing everything round about and leaving no part without a share in itself. This word, however, does not appear everywhere, but in the wilderness of the passions and vices. And it is fine to think and to be thought, and exceedingly translucent and pure to behold, and it is like coriander seed. Farmers say that the seed of coriander, divided into countless pieces and cut, sprouts in each of its parts and sections just as the whole was able to do. Such too is the word of God, beneficial through the whole and through every part, even the smallest. Perhaps too it resembles the pupil of the eye. For as this, though the smallest part, sees the whole zones of existing things, the boundless sea, the vastness of the air, and all of heaven that the rising and setting sun marks out, so too the word of God is most keen-sighted, able to oversee all things, by which those things worthy of contemplation will be beheld. Wherefore it is also white. For what could be brighter or more far-shining than the divine word, by participation in which other things too drive off mist and gloom, longing to share in the light of the soul? A peculiar effect attends this word. For whenever it calls the soul to itself, it rouses a firmness against everything earthy, bodily, and given to sense perception. Hence it is said to be like frost upon the ground, Exod 16:14. For indeed, when the one who sees God practices flight from the passions, the waves are frozen fast. That is, their onrush and swelling and vaunting are stilled. For the waves were congealed in the midst of the sea. Exod 15:8, so that the one who beholds being might cross over the passion. So the souls that have already experienced the word but are not yet able to say what it is, Exod 16:15, inquire of one another. For indeed, when sweetened, we are often ignorant of what stirred the taste, and smelling sweet fragrances, we do not know what they are. So too the soul, often gladdened, cannot say what it is that has gladdened it. But it is taught by the Hierophant and Prophet Moses, who will say, "This is the bread, Ibid," the food which God has given the soul to partake of his own word and his own reason. For this is the bread which he has given us to eat, this word. And he says also in Deuteronomy, "And he afflicted you, and made you hunger, and fed you with the manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might announce to you that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that goes forth through the mouth of God." Deut 8:3. This affliction is a propitiation, for indeed on the 10th day he propitiates our souls for our evils, Lev 16:30. For whenever we are stripped bare, we suppose we are being afflicted, but in truth this is to have God gracious toward us. Let God then announce to the soul, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds through the mouth of God." That is, the soul will be nourished both by the whole of the word and by a part of it. For the mouth is a symbol of the word, and the utterance a part of it. The more perfect souls are nourished by the whole word, but we ourselves would be content if we were nourished even by a part of it. Yet these pray to be nourished by God's word. Jacob, however, rises even above the word itself, and says that he is nourished by God directly, speaking thus, "God, in whose sight my fathers Abraham and Isaac were well-pleasing, the God who has nourished me from my youth until this day, the angel who rescues me from all evils, may he bless these children." This is a beautiful way of putting it. He regards God, not the word, as his nourisher, but the angel, who is the word, as a physician of evils. This is entirely fitting, for it pleases him that the primary goods should be given by being itself, in its own person, but the secondary goods through his angels and words. And secondary are all those that consist in deliverance from evils. For this reason, I think, plain health, which is not preceded by disease in our bodies, God grants through himself alone, while the recovery that comes by escape from disease he grants also through art and medicine, crediting both the science and the physician with the appearance of healing, while in truth he himself heals both through these means and without them. The same holds also for the soul. The goods, the nourishments, he grants through himself alone, but whatever consists in deliverance from evils, through angels and words. Jacob offered this prayer while finding fault with the statesman Joseph, who had dared to say, "I will nourish you there." For he says, "Hasten and go up to my father and say to him, thus says," and so forth, and then, "Come down to me and do not remain, for I will nourish you there in every respect, for there are 5 years of famine left." So at once reproaching and instructing the man who fancied himself wise, Jacob says, "Know, sir, that the nourishments of the soul are the sciences, which not sense perceptible speech but God bestows, he who nourishes me from youth and earliest prime, and who himself will fill me to the end." Joseph, then, suffered the same thing as his mother Rachel. For she too thought that something created could accomplish this, and so she says, "Give me children." But the supplanter, rebuking her, will say, "You have wandered into great error, for I am not in the place of God, who alone is able to open the wombs of souls and sow virtues in them and make them pregnant and bring forth what is good. Consider, indeed, your sister Leah, and you will find that she receives her seed and offspring from no created thing, but from God himself. For the Lord, seeing that Leah was hated, opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." But observe again the fine workmanship in this passage. It is virtue's womb that God opens, sowing in it good actions. And the womb, having received virtue from God, does not bear children for God, for he who is has need of nothing, but for me, Jacob. For it was for my sake, it seems, that God sowed in virtue, not for his own. So then, one man turns out to be the husband of Leah, who lies quietly by, and another the father of Leah's children. The husband is the one who opens the womb, but the father is the one to whom the children are said to be born. "And I will put enmity between you and between the woman. Pleasure truly is an enemy to sense perception, although to some it seems to be its closest friend. But just as no one would call a flatterer a companion, for flattery is a disease of friendship, nor call a courtesan well-disposed toward her lover, since her affection attaches to the gifts given, not to the man himself, so too, if you examine pleasure, you will find it assuming a counterfeit intimacy with sense perception. At any rate, whenever we are sated with pleasure, our sense organs collapse from their proper tension. Do you not observe that those who are drunk with wine or with love, though seeing, do not see, and though hearing, do not hear, and are deprived of the precise operation of their other senses as well? And sometimes, too, through an immoderate quantity of food, all the tensions of the senses are relaxed as sleep takes hold, a state which indeed took its very name from this relaxation. For then the sense organ goes slack, whereas in waking it is drawn taut, no longer receiving the impacts from without as muffled, but as loud and vivid, transmitting their reverberation all the way to the mind. For the mind must, once struck, recognize the external thing and receive a clear impression of it. Notice, too, that he did not say, "I will put enmity between you and the woman," but "between you and between the woman." Why is this? Because the war between these two takes place around the middle ground, as it were lying on the boundary between pleasure and sense perception. And the middle ground common to both is the drinkable, the edible, whatever is fitted for such purposes, each of which is both perceptible by sense and productive of pleasure. So whenever pleasure gorges itself insatiably on these things, it at once inflicts harm on sense perception. And the phrase "between your seed and her seed" is likewise spoken with an eye to nature. For every seed is a beginning of generation, and the beginning of pleasure is not passion but irrational impulse, while the beginning of sense perception is the mind. For from the mind, as from a kind of spring, the perceptive faculties are extended, especially according to the most sacred Moses, who says that woman was fashioned out of Adam, that is, sense perception out of mind. So then, what pleasure is to sense perception, passion is to mind, so that since the former pair are enemies, these two would be at war. And the war between them is quite plain to see. Whenever the mind gains the upper hand, when it turns to the intelligible and incorporeal realities, passion is put to flight. And conversely, whenever passion wins an evil victory, the mind yields, being prevented from attending to itself and to all its own works. Elsewhere, indeed, Moses says that whenever Moses lifted up his hands, Israel prevailed, but whenever he let them down, Amalek prevailed, showing by this that whenever the mind lifts itself above mortal things and is raised on high, that which sees God, which is Israel, grows strong. But whenever it relaxes its own tensions and grows weak, passion at once grows strong, that is, Amalek, whose name is translated, a people that licks up. For it truly devours the whole soul and licks it clean, leaving in it no seed or spark of virtue. For this reason it is also said, "The beginning of the nations is Amalek," because over the mixed, motley, and confused rabble, passion rules and holds sway without deliberation. Through this, the entire war of the soul is kindled. To those minds, then, to whom God grants peace, he promises that he will blot out the memorial of Amalek from under heaven. The phrase, "he will watch your head, and you will watch his heel," is, in its wording, a solecism, but in its meaning, correct. For it is said to the serpent concerning the woman, "Yet the woman is not he, but she." What, then, must we say? The statement has passed from the discourse about the woman to her seed and its origin, and the origin of sense perception was the mind. This is masculine, and of it one must properly say, "he and his," and the like. Rightly, then, it is said to pleasure that your mind will watch its chief and governing doctrine, and you will watch his, the mind's, footholds and settlings in of what pleases it, to which the heels have fittingly been compared. The word "will watch" indicates two things: one, as it were, to guard and preserve; the other, equivalent to "will keep watch" with a view to destruction. Now the mind must be either base or excellent. The foolish mind would become pleasure's guardian and steward, for it delights in it. But the excellent mind is its enemy, watching for the moment when, by attacking, it will have strength to overthrow it utterly. And conversely, pleasure preserves its foothold in the foolish man, but in the wise man it strives to undo and destroy his resistance, considering that the wise man is practicing its own dissolution, while the foolish man is practicing, by every means, its own preservation. But nevertheless, though it seems to supplant and deceive the man of worth, pleasure itself will be supplanted by Jacob, who has been trained in wrestling, not a wrestling of the body, but that in which the soul wrestles against its adversary dispositions, fighting against passions and vices. And it will not release the heel of its adversary, passion, until it has forced it to renounce itself and confess that it has been supplanted and defeated twice, both in the matter of the birthright and in the matter of the blessing. Justly, he says, was his name called Jacob, for he has now supplanted me a second time. The first time he took my birthright, and now he has taken my blessing. The base man regards the things of the body as senior, but the man of worth regards the things of the soul as senior. And these are, in truth, senior and genuinely first, not in time but in power and worth, just as a ruler is senior in a city. And the soul is the guiding element of the composite being. So the one who is first in virtue has taken the first things, which indeed belong to him by right. For he has taken good judgment too, together with perfect prayers. But foolish and self-conceited is the one who says, he has taken my blessings and my birthright. For it is not your things, sir, that he takes, but their opposites. For yours are fit for slavery, but his have been deemed worthy of mastery. And if you are willing to become a slave of the wise man, you will share in admonition and correction, casting off ignorance and lack of discipline, the banes of the soul. For the father in his prayer says to you, you will serve your brother, but not now, for he will not tolerate you while you are unruly. But when you loosen the yoke from your neck, once you have cast off the arrogance and swagger which you acquired by yoking yourself to the chariot of the passions, with folly as your charioteer. At present, you are a slave to harsh and unbearable masters within yourself, whose law it is to allow nothing free. But if you take flight and abandon them, a master fond of slaves will receive you, with good hopes of freedom, and will no longer hand you back to your former masters, having learned from Moses a necessary teaching and doctrine. Not to hand over to his master a servant who has been added to him by his master, for he shall dwell with him in every place that pleases him. But so long as you have not fled, and are still bridled by the reins of those former masters, you are unworthy to serve the wise man. You give the greatest proof of an illiberal and slavish character whenever you say, my birthright and my blessings. For these are the words of one who has gone off into boundless ignorance, since it befits God alone to say, mine. For all things are truly his possessions alone. And to this he will himself bear witness, whenever he says, my gifts, my presents, my offerings you shall keep. For gift differs from present. The one signifies the magnitude of perfect goods, which God bestows on the perfect, while the other is directed toward what is very small, in which the well-natured, striving beginners who are just glimpsing the goal have a share. For this reason, Abraham too, in following the will of God, keeps the possessions that were his from God, but sends back the horses of the king of Sodom, as well as the possessions belonging to the concubines. Moses, moreover, deems it right that the greatest matters be judged by himself, even in the greatest cases, while he entrusts the small matters of judgment to those of secondary rank to consider. But whoever dares to say that something is his own will be enrolled a slave for all eternity, like the one who says, I have loved my master and my wife and my children, I will not go away free. Well said, to confess his own slavery to himself. For how could the one who says, the Lord is not my slave, fail to see that mind is Lord of itself and self-ruling? That sense perception too is mine, a self-sufficient judge of bodies. And that the offspring of these are mine as well, of mind, the intelligibles, and of sense perception, the perceptibles, for thinking and perceiving are within my own power. But let him not merely testify against himself, but condemned also by God, let him endure a slavery eternal and most sure, God commanding that his ear be pierced, so that he may not admit the words of virtue, and that he serve mind and sense perception forever, evil and pitiless masters. And to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your griefs and your groaning. Grief is a passion peculiar to the woman, who is sense perception, for that in which pleasure occurs is the very thing in which pain occurs as well. We feel pleasure through the senses, so that of necessity we feel pain through them too. But the excellent and purified mind feels the least pain, for the senses assail it least of all. Whereas in the fool passion abounds without measure, since he has no antidote in his soul with which to ward off the plagues that come from the senses and sense objects. For the athlete and the slave are struck in different ways. The slave submits under compulsion and yields to the blows, while the athlete resists and holds his ground. And the shearer shears a man and a sheep in different ways, for the sheep is examined only in what it undergoes, whereas the man reacts and, so to speak, does something in return, adapting himself to being shorn. So too the irrational person, like a slave, submits to another and falls beneath his pains as though they were unbearable mistresses, unable even to look them in the face, since he cannot muster manly and free reasoning. And this is why an endless mass of grief is poured over him through the senses. But the person of understanding, in the manner of an athlete, stands against every pain with strength and stubborn vigor and breathes back against it, so as not to be wounded by it, but to treat each pain with indifference. And I think that, in his young man's spirit, he might cry out to pain the words of the tragedian, "Burn, char my flesh, glut yourself drinking my dark blood. Sooner shall the stars go down beneath the earth, and earth rise up into the heavens, than you shall hear from me a flattering word." And just as God has increased and multiplied all painful things for sense perception, so he has given an unstinting abundance of good things to the virtuous soul. He says, for instance, of the perfect Abraham in these words, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not spared your beloved son for my sake, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand on the seashore." Genesis 22:16-17. It is fitting that he confirmed the promise with an oath, and with an oath worthy of God. For you see that God does not swear by another, since nothing is greater than he but by himself, who is best of all. Some have said that it was improper for God to swear an oath, since an oath is taken for the sake of establishing trust, and only God is trustworthy, and whoever is a friend of God, as Moses is said to have become, faithful in all his house. Numbers 12:7. Besides, the words of God are oaths, and the laws of God are the most sacred of ordinances. And proof of his strength is that whatever he says comes to pass, which is the very thing most proper to an oath. So it would follow to say that all the words of God are oaths, confirmed by the accomplishment of deeds. Yet they say an oath is God's testimony concerning a disputed matter. If then God swears, he testifies on his own behalf, which is absurd, for the one who gives testimony must be different from the one on whose behalf it is given. What then must we say? First, that it is not blameworthy for God to testify on his own behalf, for who else could be a sufficient witness for him? Second, he himself is for himself all that is most precious: kinsman, intimate, friend, virtue, happiness, blessedness, knowledge, understanding, beginning, end, whole, all, judge, judgment, counsel, law, action, sovereignty. Moreover, if we take, "By myself I have sworn," in the way we ought, we shall stop being overclever sophists about it. Perhaps it means this: nothing capable of giving assurance can give firm assurance about God, for he has shown his nature to no one, but has made it invisible to the whole created order. Who could have the strength to declare firmly whether the cause of all things is bodiless or a body, of a certain quality or without quality, or in general to pronounce with certainty about his substance, quality, relation, or motion? But about himself alone he can affirm with strength, since he alone has known his own nature accurately and without falsehood. God, then, is the strongest guarantor first of himself, and then alone of his own works. So it was fitting that he swore by himself, giving assurance of himself, which no one else could do. For this reason, those who claim to swear by God might rightly be thought impious, for no one can rightly swear by him, since no one can know his nature with certainty. Instead, we should be content if we are able to swear by his name, that is, by the interpretive word. For this would be our God, we who are imperfect, while for the wise and perfect it is the first and highest God. And indeed Moses, marveling at the surpassing greatness of the uncreated, says, "And you shall swear by his name," Deuteronomy 6:13, "not by him himself, for it is enough for a created being to be given assurance and testimony by the divine word, but let God be his own trust and his own most certain testimony." Because of which you did this thing, Genesis 22:16, is a symbol of piety, for to do everything for God's sake alone is piety. This is why we do not spare even our beloved child, virtue, or its happiness, but yield it to the Creator, judging the offspring worthy to be reckoned the possession of God rather than of any created being. It is well said, "Blessing I will bless," Ibid. For many people do many praiseworthy things, but not out of a settled disposition to bless, since even a base person sometimes does what is fitting, not from a fitting disposition. And one who is drunk or mad may at times speak and act soberly, but not from a sober mind. And even quite small children, not yet from a rational disposition, for nature has not yet trained them to be rational, do and say many things that rational people do. But the lawgiver wants the wise person to seem praiseworthy not by circumstance, easily, or as if by chance, but from a settled habit and disposition of being praiseworthy. It was not enough, then, for ill-fated sense perception to indulge richly in griefs, but also in groaning. Groaning is intense and heightened grief, for often we feel pain without groaning, but when we groan, we handle our griefs with distress and with a veritable downpour. Groaning is of two kinds. One occurs in those who desire and reach after wrongdoing and do not attain it, and this is base. The other occurs in those who repent and are troubled at their former turning, saying, "Wretched are we, for how long a time we lay unaware, sick with the sickness of folly and mindlessness and unjust practices." But this does not happen unless the king of Egypt, the godless and pleasure-loving disposition, comes to an end and dies out of the soul. For after those many days, the king of Egypt died. Then immediately, once vice has died, the one who sees God groans also over his own turning. For the sons of Israel groaned because of their bodily and Egyptian labors. Exodus 2, 23. Since while the pleasure-loving disposition still lives in us, it persuades the soul to rejoice in the wrongs it commits, but when it dies, the soul groans. This is why the soul also cries out, imploring the Master that it may no longer turn back nor receive an incomplete perfecting. For God has not permitted many souls, though they wish to make use of repentance, but they were carried back again, as though by a returning tide, in the manner of Lot's wife, Genesis 19:26, who was turned to stone because she loved Sodom and the natures overturned by God, but now, in fact, it says that their cry went up to God. Exodus 2:23. Bearing witness to the grace of the existent one. For had he not powerfully called the suppliant reason to himself, it would not have gone up, that is, it would not have been raised and grown and begun to soar aloft, fleeing the lowliness of earthly things. This is why, further on, he says, "Behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me," Exodus 3, 9. It is a fine thing that supplication reaches all the way to God, but it would not have reached him had not the one who calls been good. To some souls he comes to meet even beforehand. "I will come to you, and I will bless you," Exodus 20, 24. You see how great is the grace of the cause, who outruns our slowness to act and comes to meet the soul beforehand for its complete benefit. And what is said here is a doctrinal oracle, for if the concept of God enters the mind, at once the mind becomes sound in judgment and all its sicknesses are healed. Sense perception, however, is always in grief and groans, and gives birth to the act of perceiving amid pain and incurable distress, as it itself says. "In pain you shall bear children," Genesis 3, 16. Sight gives birth to seeing, hearing to hearing, taste to tasting, and sense perception in general to perceiving. But for the fool none of these is done without harsh distress, for he sees, hears, tastes, smells, and perceives in general, all with grief. But virtue, by contrast, you will find bearing its child with surpassing joy, and the virtuous person begetting it with laughter and good cheer, and the offspring of both being laughter itself. That the wise man begets in joy and not in grief, the divine word itself will testify, saying, "God said to Abraham, Sarah your wife shall no longer be called Sarah, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her and give you a child from her." Genesis 17:15-16, and then it adds, "Abraham fell upon his face and said, Shall a child be born to a man 100 years old, and shall Sarah, being 90 years old, bear a child?" Ibid. 17. This man, it seems, was glad and laughing, because he was about to beget happiness, that is, Isaac, and virtue Sarah also laughs, as the same text will testify, saying, "It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women, and she laughed within her mind and said, Has not happiness come to me even until now? But my Lord, the divine word, is old, Genesis 18, 11-12, to whom this quality must belong of necessity, and it is good to trust one who promises what is good. And the offspring is laughter and joy, for this is what Isaac means when translated. Let sense perception, then, grieve, but let virtue always rejoice. For indeed, once happiness has been born, she says with solemn pride, the Lord has made laughter for me, for whoever hears will rejoice with me. Genesis 21:6. Open your ears wide, then, initiates, and receive these most sacred mysteries. Laughter is joy, and made is equivalent to begot, so that what is being said is this, the Lord begot Isaac, for he himself is the father of the perfect nature, sowing happiness in souls and begetting it. And your turning shall be toward your husband. Genesis 3:16. There are two husbands of sense perception, the lawful one and the seducer. For in the manner of a husband, the visible object moves sight, sound moves hearing, and flavor moves taste, and so with each of the other senses. These things turn irrational sense perception toward themselves, calling it, and overpower and rule it. For beauty has enslaved sight, sweet flavor has enslaved taste, and likewise each of the other sensible objects enslaves the sense perception proper to it. Consider the glutton, how he is enslaved to whatever elaborate preparations cooks and bakers can contrive by their craft, and the person swept away by melody, how he is mastered by the lyre or the flute or by anyone skilled in singing. But for the sense perception that has turned back toward its lawful husband, the mind, the benefit is very great. Let us next consider, then, what is said about the mind itself when it is moved contrary to right reason. To Adam God said, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat, from it you have eaten, cursed is the earth in your labors. Genesis 3:17. It is most unprofitable to hear of a mind belonging to sense perception rather than a sense perception belonging to the mind. For the better must always rule and the worse be ruled, and the mind is better than sense perception. Just as, when a charioteer is in control and drives the animals with the reins where he wishes, the chariot is carried along well. But when those animals have thrown off restraint and gained the upper hand, the charioteer is often dragged along, and the animals themselves are sometimes carried by the impetus of their rush into a pit, and everything proceeds in disorder. And a ship sails a straight course when the pilot takes the helm and steers it accordingly, but capsizes when a contrary wind blows over the sea and the swell takes hold of it. So too, whenever the mind, the charioteer or pilot of the soul, governs the whole living being like the ruler of a city, life is guided rightly. But whenever irrational sense perception carries off the first place, terrible confusion takes hold, as when slaves have set themselves over their masters. For then, to tell the truth, the mind is set ablaze and burns, since the senses stir up the flame by presenting sensible objects as fuel. And indeed, Moses points to this sort of conflagration, which comes about through the senses of the mind when he says, and the women further kindled a fire in Moab. For this name is translated from a father, and our father is the mind. Then, he says, the riddle makers will say, come to Heshbon, that the city of Sihon may be built and prepared. For fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon, and it consumed as far as Moab and swallowed up the pillars of the Arnon. Woe to you, Moab, you have perished, people of Chemosh. Their sons were given up to be saved, and their daughters were captives to the king of the Amorites, Sihon, and their seed shall perish from Heshbon as far as Dibon, and the women kindled a further fire against Moab. Num. 21:27-30. Heshbon is translated reckonings. These are riddles full of obscurity. The physician's reckoning pours down like rain. I will purge the sick man, I will nourish him, I will heal him with drugs and with diet, I will cut, I will cauterize. But often nature, even without these, has healed, and with these has destroyed, so that all the physician's calculations are found to be dreams, full of obscurity and riddles. Again the farmer says, I will cast seeds, I will plant, the plants will grow, they will bear fruits which will be useful not only for the necessary enjoyment, but will also suffice for abundance. Then suddenly a blaze or a storm or continuous downpours destroy everything. And sometimes the crops are brought to completion, but the one who reckoned on them gains no benefit, but dies beforehand, and vainly prophesies enjoyment from the fruits of his labors. It is best then to have put one's trust in God and not in obscure reckonings and unstable conjectures. Abraham indeed trusted God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Gen 15:6. And Moses at the outset is attested to be faithful in the whole house, Num 12:7. But if we distrust God and put our trust instead in our own reckonings, we shall construct and build the city of the mind that corrupts truth. For Sihon is translated, one who corrupts. Wherefore also he who arose, he in whom the dreams were, found that all the motions and stretchings of the fool are dreams having no share in truth, for the mind itself was found to be a dream, because it is a true doctrine to trust in God, but a falsehood to trust in empty reckonings. And an irrational impulse goes out and ranges abroad from both, from the reckonings and from the mind that corrupts truth. Wherefore he also says, fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon, Num 21:28. For it is equally irrational to trust either in plausible reckonings or in that which corrupts the truth. It consumes even as far as Moab, that is, as far as the mind, for whom else does false opinion deceive but the wretched mind? It consumes and devours, and indeed also swallows down the pillars within it, that is, the particular notions, which have been stamped and engraved as on a pillar. And the pillars belong to the Arnon, which is translated their light, since each of these matters is made clear by reasoning. He begins then to lament the self-willed and self-loving mind thus, woe to you, Moab, you have perished, for if you attend to riddles that follow the impulse of plausibilities, you have destroyed the truth. The people of Chemosh, that is, your people and your power, is found maimed and blinded, for Chemosh is translated a groping, and this is properly the work of one who does not see. Of these, the sons are the particular reckonings, fugitives, while the daughters, who possess the capacity that belongs to them, are captives to the king of the Amorites, that is, to the sophist of those who speak. For the Amorites are translated speakers, being a symbol of uttered speech. And their leader is the sophist, clever at hunting out the arts of words, by whom those who transgress the boundary of truth are outwitted. Sihon, then, is the one who corrupts the sound rule of truth, and his seed shall perish, and Heshbon, the sophistic riddles as far as Dibon, which is called judgment. Very fittingly, for plausibilities and probabilities have no knowledge of truth, but lawsuit and dispute and contentious rivalry and love of strife and all such things. But it was not enough for the mind to have its own intelligible destructive powers. The women too kindled a further fire, the senses adding a great conflagration upon it. See indeed what is meant. Often at night, when none of the senses is active, we conceive absurd notions about many different things, since the soul is ever in motion and admits countless changes. What she herself generated from herself was, then, already sufficient for her own corruption. But now the crowd of the senses has also brought in upon her, as an added scene, a countless multitude of destructive powers, some from things seen, some from sounds, and then from tastes and from the vapors of smell. And the flame that arises from these disposes the soul more harshly than the flame that arises from the soul itself alone, without the added participation of the organs of sense. One of these women is the wife of Potiphar, Pharaoh's chief cook, Gen 39:1. How it is that, being a eunuch, he has a wife, must be examined. For those who deal with the words of the law before turning to allegory will meet with what seems to be a difficulty. For the eunuch and chief cook is in reality the mind that makes use not only of simple, but also of superfluous pleasures, and is called a eunuch, barren of wisdom, a eunuch of none other than Pharaoh, the scatterer of noble things. Since indeed, on another argument, it would be best to become a eunuch, if our soul, having escaped vice, could unlearn passion. Wherefore also Joseph, the temperate disposition when pleasure says to him, lie with me, Gen 39:7, and being a man, feel as a man feels, and enjoy the pleasant things of life, opposes her, saying, I shall sin against God, the lover of virtue, if I should become a lover of pleasure, for this is a wicked deed. And at first she skirmishes at long range, but presently she also fights strenuously, whenever the soul enters her own house and, running back to her own proper powers, renounces the things of the body and performs her own works as works of the soul, neither into the house of Joseph nor of Potiphar, but into the house, and it does not add whose, so that you may allegorize with due caution, to do his works. Gen 39:11. The house, then, is the soul, into which he runs back, leaving behind external things, so that, as the saying goes, he may come to be within himself. And the works of the temperate man are, perhaps, done by the will of God, for indeed no reasoning alien to those accustomed to dwell within the soul was present there. Yet pleasure does not withdraw but continues the struggle, and taking hold of his garment says, "Lie with me." And just as garments are coverings of the body, so food and drink are coverings of the living creature. This, then, is what she says. Why do you refuse pleasure, without which you cannot live? See, I take hold of the things that produce her, and I say that you could not endure unless you made use of one of the things that produce her. What then, does the temperate man say? If I am to be enslaved to passion because of the matter that produces it, he says, then I will go forth outside the passion. For leaving the garments in her hands, he fled and went outside. Gen 39:12. But who, one might ask, goes outside from within? Are there not many such? Or have not some, fleeing from committing sacrilege, instead stolen from a private house, and, though not strikers of their own fathers, done outrage to another's property? Such men go out from one sin, but enter into others. But the man who is perfectly temperate must flee all sins, both the greater and the lesser, and be tested in none of them whatsoever. But Joseph, for he is young, and was not strong enough, in an Egyptian body, to contend against and conquer pleasure, flees. But Phinehas the priest, who was zealous with zeal on behalf of God, did not procure his own safety by flight, but taking the javelin, that is, the zealous word, did not draw back until he had pierced the Midianite woman, the nature chosen out from the divine company, through her womb, numb. 25:7-8, so that never again might a plant or seed of vice be able to spring up. Wherefore, folly having been cut away, the soul receives a double prize and portion, peace and priesthood ibid. 12:13, virtues akin and sisterly to one another. To such a woman, then, one must not listen, I mean depraved sense perception, since indeed, God dealt well with the midwives, Exod. 1:20, because they disregarded the commands of Pharaoh the scatterer, keeping alive the males of the soul, which he wished to destroy, being a lover of the female matter and ignorant of the cause, saying, I do not know him, Exod. 5:2. But one must obey another woman, such as Sarah proved to be, ruling virtue. And the wise Abraham indeed obeys her when she counsels what is needful. For earlier, when he had not yet become perfect, but while before his name was changed, he still philosophized about things on high, she, knowing that he could not beget from a fuller virtue, advises him to have children from the handmaid, that is, from encyclical education, Hagar Gen 16:2 FF, whose name means sojourning. For the one who practices dwelling in perfect virtue, before being enrolled as a citizen of her city, sojourns among the encyclical branches of learning, so that through these he may set out unhindered toward perfect virtue. Then, when she sees him made perfect and now able to sow. And if he, being grateful toward the branches of learning through which he was established in virtue, thinks it hard to dismiss them, he will be soothed by the oracle of God who commands. Whatever Sarah says to you, listen to her voice. Gen 21:12. Let it be a law for each of us, what seems good to virtue. For if we are willing to listen to everything virtue advises, we shall be happy. The words, and you ate from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat, this alone, are equivalent to you consented to vice, which you ought to have resisted with all your strength. For this reason, it is not you who are cursed, but the earth in your works. Gen 3:17. What then is the cause of these things? It was the serpent, pleasure, the irrational uplifting of the soul. This is accursed of itself, and comes upon the base man alone, upon none who is good. Adam is the intermediate mind, which is examined now as better, now as worse. For insofar as it is mind, it is by nature neither base nor good, but is accustomed to change toward the better or the worse through virtue and through vice. Reasonably, then, he himself is not cursed of himself, as being neither vice nor an action in accordance with vice, but the earth is cursed in his works. For the actions performed through the whole soul, which he has called earth, are censurable and blameworthy according to the wickedness of each one who performs them. Wherefore he adds also that you shall eat it in grief, which is equivalent to you shall enjoy your soul with grief. For the base man passes his whole life painfully in the use of his own soul, having nothing that is a cause of joy, which justice and prudence and the virtues enthroned alongside these are by nature apt to produce. Thorns then and thistles it shall bring forth for you, Gen 3:18. But what grows and sprouts in the soul of the fool except the passions that prick and wound it? These he has called, by way of symbol, thorns, which the irrational impulse, after the manner of fire, first encounters, and once kindled with these, burns up and destroys all that belongs to it. For he speaks thus, if fire goes out and finds thorns, and sets fire also to a thrashing floor or standing grain or a field, he who kindled the fire shall make restitution, Exod. 22:6. You see that the fire that goes out, the irrational impulse, does not set the thorns on fire, but finds them. For being in search of the passions, it finds what it desired to seize. And when it finds them, it burns up these three things: perfect virtue, progress, and a good natural disposition. Perfect virtue, then, he has compared to the thrashing floor. For just as the crop is gathered there, so too in the soul of the wise man the noble things are gathered together. Progress he compares to standing grain, since each of these is incomplete, still reaching toward its end, and good natural disposition to a field, because it is well suited to receive the seeds of virtue. Each of the passions he has called thistles, since it is threefold, the passion itself, that which produces it, and the result that comes from these, for instance, pleasure the pleasant to feel pleasure, desire the desirable to desire, grief the grievous to grieve, fear the fearful to fear. And you shall eat the grass of the field, in the sweat of your face you shall eat your bread, Gen 3:18-19. He calls grass and bread by the same name, as though they were one and the same thing. Grass is food for an irrational creature, and the base person is irrational, having cut himself off from right reason, and the senses too are irrational, being a part of the soul. When the mind reaches for objects of sense perception through the irrational senses, it does not reach for them without toil and sweat. For the life of the fool is exceedingly painful and burdensome as he pursues and licks after the things that produce pleasures and all that vice loves to bring about. And for how long? Until, he says, you return to the earth from which you were taken, Gen 3:19. For is he not now examined among earthly and unstable things, having abandoned heavenly wisdom? In what way, then, does he still turn back? This must be considered. But perhaps what is meant is this. The foolish mind has always turned away from right reason and has been taken not from the ethereal nature but from the more earthly matter. And whether it stays still or moves, it remains the same, reaching for the same things. This is why he adds, for you are earth, and to earth you shall return, Ibid, which amounts to the same as what was said before. And this too it shows. Your beginning and your end are one and the same, for you began from the perishable bodies of earth, and you will end again in those same things, having worn down the road of life between not a highway, but a rough path, full of briars and thorns that are apt to prick and wound.